Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Philip Connors is here. His debut book, Fire Season, told of his decade as a fire lookout high above the Gila National Forest in southern New Mexico and was a major hit. His second book, All the Wrong Places, is the story of why he took that job as a fire lookout and how he spent the prior years reeling, trying to understand his younger brother's suicide in his early 20s. Philip Connors, welcome back to the program.
Stephen, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
Phil, there's a hint in Fire Season of what this second book is going to be about, and I gave a tiny description, but I wonder if you can expand a bit and tell us what All the Wrong Places is about.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I did hint at it in Fire Season because I thought in that book it might be natural for a reader to wonder, so why the heck does this guy enjoy spending 100 days a year in solitude by himself on a mountaintop in the Gila? And this book expands on that backstory. In a way, it's sort of the prequel to Fire Season. It tells the story of the years that I spent kind of wandering aimlessly and purposelessly in the aftermath of my brother's suicide, which covers it, you know, it covers roughly 1996 to 2002. And it's in a way, it's sort of a coming of age story, but with this major event from my personal history shadowing everything.
Well, you know, from my point of view, I want to congratulate you on writing such an intensely moving and personal story that I guess one of the questions for me is, how did you let down the barriers you let down? Because, I mean, you tell your story warts and all, and I, to tell you the truth, I don't think I could do it. I don't think I could let down those barriers.
Well, one way I did it was by working on it for almost a decade off and on, because you're right, it's not the easiest thing to do. But my working sense as I worked on this book was that suicide is perhaps the hardest thing to talk about, literally in our culture, the hardest thing.
Yeah, it's really not talked about, is it?
Right. My sense is that it's a taboo subject almost. Every once in a while, it erupts into the public conversation with the death of someone like Robin Williams, let's say. But because it's so hard to talk about, I figured the only way to really write a book about the subject is to be as unvarnished and as candid and as ruthlessly self-examining as possible. And yeah, it took a really long time to get it right. But if I'm going to try to chip away at the taboo that is this subject, it seems to me the only way to do it is not to go halfway, but to really expose what this act of my brother's did to my life in the hope of connecting with readers who may have had a similar experience, or perhaps showing readers who haven't had a similar experience what it's like to live through something like this.
You know, I think with any suicide, friends and family feel a responsibility toward the person who killed themselves. But you really felt directly responsible. And I wonder, there's a reading on page 150 where you describe this. That first, starting with that first full paragraph, and I wondered if you could read that for us.
Yeah, just to set it up for you, on the day before he died, I got a call from my mother, who had talked to my brother Dan earlier in the day, and she said to me, you know, he sounded kind of down on the phone. Maybe you should give him a call. And I thought to myself, yeah, I'll call him maybe in a few days. And I never got the chance. Okay. I should have called him. I could have called him. That's what I kept thinking, staring at that empty page. I should have called him. I could have called him. My mother had suggested as much, and I had put it off. I'd figured it could wait. The sight of that telephone in the police photos only confirmed my conviction that I'd had a chance to save him and missed it. There was no way around it. The phone was right there, within arm's reach. Its ringing could have changed the course of his day. My voice could have given him a reason to live. I'd never have known it, of course. Hard to imagine him saying, months later, "So, bro, that time you called me after the breakup, you saved my life." Instead, he was gone. Still and forever gone.
Yeah, and the book is, to some extent, about your trying to discover why this happened. But in fairness to the book, it's about so much more than that. And some of it actually is has nothing to do with that. And one of the things that at least grabbed me was this early turning point in your life when you sort of right out of journalism school get a job at one of the premier newspapers in the world, the Wall Street Journal. And that it seems like it would be a home run. But for you, I'm not sure it was really a home run.
You know, yeah, you're right. It should have been. It should have been a feather in my cap. Young graduates of journalism schools across the country dream of landing a job like that. The funny thing was, my first thought was, the Wall Street Journal, that just doesn't feel right to me. In journalism school in college, one of my professors had often said the line that journalism was a means of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. And I thought to myself, boy, the Wall Street Journal seems like the least likely place in the world where a person could comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And so I spent several years working there, but you're right, I never felt comfortable there. I never felt quite at home. My politics seemed out of place there, and it even felt weird to wear a suit and tie to work every day. It just didn't feel natural.
You know, one of the things about the job is that, and we listeners will appreciate this, it was a very lowly job. I mean, this was not, you know, sending you out to cover, you know, corporate stories. You were delivering faxes and filling the water cooler.
Exactly, yeah. I was hired as what was called an editorial assistant, a news assistant. And, you know, even though the word editorial or news was in my title, I really had nothing to do with the pursuit of news. I was, as you say, a fax fetcher and a water cooler replenisher. I was the lowest man on the totem pole. But it was a way in the door at a major American institution of journalism.
Yeah, and let me come back to that point. But before I do so, let me mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. I'm very pleased to have Philip Connors back on the show. He's written a book that I really enjoyed called All the Wrong Places. And Philip, I was very interested in your first big break because I did securities litigation, and for a while I actually read the Wall Street Journal pretty thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And I would always glance at that column, the one on the far right, and that ends up being your sort of first big break into the Wall Street Journal and actually writing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's called, at the paper, the A-head. It's on the front page of the paper, and it's usually, you know, the front page of the Wall Street Journal is hard-hitting, really meaty, newsy stuff, typically every single day. But the A-head was this little island of levity or strangeness in that sea of hard news. And I just got a phone call out of the blue one day at the office. Again, thanks to my old professor at the University of Montana, someone had called him and said, you know, I've got an interesting story,
yeah,
but
I
don't know.
I should break in and just say, here, you're a graduate of the University of Montana, you're the son of Minnesota pig farmers, and your first job out of journalism school is at the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
But go ahead with your story.
How unlikely is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, how unlikely, right.
So I get this call because my mentor and journalism professor had told this guy to call me. And the tip he had to share was that he knew of a man who had made it his life's goal to eat at every single McDonald's restaurant in North America. Now, my first thought was, okay, I'm not sure if that's really news, but tell me more. Well, it turned out the guy had eaten at something like 10,890 McDonald's restaurants, and he had the notation to prove it. And so I followed up on it. I met the guy for lunch, naturally at a McDonald's restaurant in Lower Manhattan. He had come to the city on business. And I ended up reporting this story, and literally my first story at the Wall Street Journal ends up on the front page, yet another unlikely event in the life of a young man.
Well, one of the things that amazed me was the amount of fact-checking that you were required to do on what you might call a human interest story.
Yeah, it's the Wall Street Journal, so the standards are incredibly rigorous. I couldn't take his word that he had been to 10,890 McDonald's. I needed proof, and he actually had notations, notes he had kept, the date and time he had been there, what he had eaten, what the decor was like, if it varied in any way from the standards. So I had him FedEx me these documents, and I and my editor looked them over, and then we called ex-girlfriends and other people who knew him to confirm this story. So it was really like reporting some kind of tough investigative enterprise piece or something. But the result was a lighthearted, strange tale of this man's obsession with McDonald's.
So you end up becoming the copy editor for the Arts and Leisure section of the Wall Street Journal, which at that time was a large section of the newspaper, and was really a quite interesting section. It was jazz, it was literature, it was all kinds of stuff that people might, movies, all kinds of things like that. And I wonder, how important was it for you to have written this first cover story in order to get that job as the copy editor for Arts and Leisure?
Yeah, well, I should point out one thing is that there were two separate leisure and arts things at the Journal at the time. There was a full section of the paper that dealt with it once a week.
Yes.
And then there was a daily page called the Leisure and Arts page, and that's where I worked, just on that one page of the paper.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Each day. I think it didn't hurt the cause, you know, to have had a story on the front page, because that led to me getting a few other breaks on writing news stories, covering for reporters who were out on vacation, or little things that might have fallen between the cracks if I hadn't picked them up. So my name was appearing in the paper. I was showing people, I guess, that I could do this sort of work. And I reached a point where I probably had a choice. I could push ahead with being a reporter and writing news for the paper, or I could jump at this chance I saw to be a copy editor on the Leisure and Arts page. And I felt, I don't know, that it would be more in keeping with what I wanted to do to work with arts pieces. So I jumped that.
So one of the really funny, and there's parts of this book that are very funny, and one of the things that had to happen before you could get this position as a copy editor was that you had to meet with Bob Bartley, who was the he wrote the editorials for the Wall Street Journal, and he was sort of notorious for being, well, incredibly conservative. And you write about that in the book, on page 65, the second paragraph there. And I wonder if you could read part of that paragraph to us.
Sure. Bob Bartley's two abiding obsessions were taxes and weapons. He thought taxes should be cut always and everywhere, except for poor people, on whom they should be raised as a disincentive to being poor. And as for weapons, he thought America should build as many as possible. The more weapons we had, in his view, the less likely we were to need them. But he believed that occasionally we needed them to bomb other nations that were trying to develop them too, because those nations couldn't be trusted not to use them.
And one of the themes in your book is you're very concerned about being associated with this editorial stance, particularly, I think, the drumbeat for the Iraq War really bothers you. But, you know, all the major media was beating the drum for the Iraq War, and I'm just wondering, first of all, you know, like the New York Times editorial page was beating the drum. They had Judith Miller, who's writing stories about WMD. I mean, do you think you're being at all hard on the Wall Street Journal by singling them out for beating this drum?
Well, not really. You're right. They were not alone. In fact, as you point out, other, you know, more liberal news media organizations were just as keen to go to war with Iraq. It seemed to me that the Wall Street Journal editorial page was more relentless than anybody else and more willing to distort the truth.
This guy Bartley was relentless about over. I mean, one of the things that's striking, if you ever read those editorials, they seem so repetitive, and they seem to be about the same thing over and over and over again.
Well, that's an old trick of rhetoric, is if you repeat something often enough, you can penetrate the consciousness of your readership in a way that you can't if you just are constantly moving on to other subjects. He had a few sort of obsessions, as I point out, tax rates, missile defense, military buildup, and he had long thought that we didn't go far enough in the first Gulf War, and that Saddam Hussein should have been deposed. And so even though Saddam Hussein turned out to have nothing to do with 9/11, he and the editorial page latched on to 9/11 as a means to kind of finish what they perceived to be this unfinished business of removing Saddam Hussein from power. And I think it was a grave mistake. It's cost us $1 trillion and counting. And again, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, but they were not above trying to make connections between Saddam and the terrorists who carried out
on the editorial page, or you think this seeped into the news coverage too?
No, that was the curious thing about reading the paper in that time period after 9/11. It was an exercise in cognitive dissonance. The news pages were reporting that intelligence officials were discounting any role by Saddam Hussein in the attacks of 9/11. And then you'd turn to the editorial page on the very same day and find precisely the opposite viewpoint. So the old saying about the Wall Street Journal is you got two newspapers for the price of one, and it was never more true than in the time right after 9/11.
Well, this is New Mexico, People, Places, and Ideas. You've just been listening to Philip Connors talk about his experience at the Wall Street Journal. My name's Stephen Spitz, and we're talking about Phil's new book, All the Wrong Places. Meanwhile, Phil, you are a young single male in New York City. You start out with a kind of a lowly job, but you get some wage increases when you go to Arts and Leisure. And you'd like some female companionship, but you write very candidly and really funny, in a funny way, about how you go about this.
Right. Well, you know, one of the after effects of living with a family member's suicide is you feel almost toxic in a way, like there's something about you that's malformed and even perhaps contagious. And so it was really hard for me to find intimacy of a sexual nature. And nonetheless, you know, I had erotic impulses. I'm not, you know, I didn't stop being human.
Yeah, you weren't a monk.
Right. I wasn't a monk. I didn't take a vow of silence and chastity. So the rather peculiar outlet that I turned to keep alive this sense of intimacy in myself at that time was a phone sex line. Which I realize is a really strange way to continue cultivating a sense of yourself as someone who, you know, has erotic impulses. But it was the only thing that made sense to me at the time, because it didn't involve face-to-face contact. It didn't really involve contact of any kind except through the voice.
But then, you know, and I had no idea this was the case, you actually hook up with some of the people you talk to on this phone sex line, and they turn out to be fairly normal, interesting people.
Yeah, you know, it was what was called an amateur phone sex line. I don't know how far we want to go into the hermeneutics of phone
sex.
I didn't realize
there were such things.
I didn't either. I always thought it was a realm for professionals, right?
Yeah.
You called and somebody who knew what they were doing walked you through the process. But this line was different. Everybody who called was an amateur, just somebody
really,
looking for connection.
Really, truly amateurs.
Really, truly amateurs.
Wow.
People just looking for connection. And so sometimes if they appreciated your recorded greeting and and you appreciated theirs, there was a way for you to connect and talk directly to each other. And, of course, the next step, what's to stop you from saying, well, I live in Queens, here's my address, if you're interested in coming over. So that happened only a couple of times over the course of a couple of years, but I actually made very interesting connections with people through that line, and I think it was a way of keeping some part of myself alive that I feared losing touch with.
So meanwhile, you're continuing what almost seems to me like a journalistic investigation of your brother's death, and you start making trips back to Albuquerque. And one of the things you do is you meet up with, I think her name is Emily, your brother's girlfriend, who you had previously met on a trip to Albuquerque. And that turns out to be a really pivotal event in your whole investigation.
Yeah. The latter parts of the book are more about that quest story that you mentioned earlier, where I'm seeking answers about my brother. I'm looking for some piece of information that will put into context why he chose death over life. And so, you know, I tracked down people who knew him. I tracked down the autopsy report and the police report.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand why you did that, because there was no doubt it was a suicide and it wasn't a murder, but you were just doing what a reporter would do, I guess.
I was doing what a reporter would do, yeah. You know, it's interesting because in the beginning of the book, I write about bringing all my reportorial instincts to bear on a story of incredible inconsequence, really, one man's obsession with McDonald's. But I'm doing it under the auspices of the Wall Street Journal, a very serious news organization. Toward the end of the book, those circumstances are almost flipped on their head. The quest has nothing to do with filling the news pages of a major American paper. It's purely a personal quest, but the subject matter is gravely serious, about as far as you can get from one man's quest to eat at every McDonald's in North America. This is about what caused my brother to commit suicide. And, you know, one of the reasons I sought out the autopsy reports and the police reports was it always struck me as odd that he probably did this late at night, but his body wasn't found for 12 hours. And he lived in an apartment complex. You'd think somebody would hear a gunshot. I never quite got an explanation for that, but I wanted to look at the police reports just in case there was some clue there. The autopsy report did tell me something that I thought was interesting, which was that his blood alcohol content was above the legal limit for driving. So he had been drinking. He was intoxicated at the time. But yeah, you point out this one crucial encounter I have with a woman who was actually engaged to be married to my brother at one time. And she gave me one piece of information that I had never known, that had eluded me. She mentioned a secret that my brother had carried for years. And that secret sort of unlocked a deeper understanding for me of why he may have made the choice he made. You know, I'm almost hesitant to spoil it for your listeners.
Oh, I don't think we should.
If they're going to read this book.
Yeah, because I don't think we should. One of the things that really struck me about your conversations with her and her family was how touched everybody your brother touched was so taken by him, had
yeah.
such positive feelings about him.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about the father and mother of the girl he broke up with, and yet they're still missing him in this really intense way. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, he was a remarkable young man. He had a lot of different talents. He was good with his hands. He was a good woodworker. He could take apart a car engine and put it back together again. He had developed a love for hot air ballooning after he moved to Albuquerque back in, I think it was 93, late 92, early 93. And, you know, the last time I saw him alive, he took me up in a hot air balloon over the city of Albuquerque. And it's one of the memories I know that will last the rest of my life. It was this remarkable introduction to his passion. And for me, an incredible experience of looking down on the world for the first time. I had never even been on a commercial airline flight at the time. I was 22 years old. He was 21. And, you know, his competence, his sense that he was actually more mature than his age, all of these really touched people and affected people. And, you know, everyone I talked to afterwards, after his death, spoke so lovingly about him, and that touched me. It also made me so sad.
Really, in the pages, in what you write, very much.
Yeah. Well, among the dozen or so things I'm trying to do in this book, one of the things was memorialize some of what was really great in this young man who was with us too brief of a time.
Well, Philip, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I would like to thank my guest so much, Philip Connors. He is the author of All the Wrong Places. Thanks also to my producer, Jefferson White, and my executive producer, Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are downloadable at iTunes under Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.